From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a tribute to the great rock and roll songwriter Doc Pomus. He co-wrote such classics as This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, Lonely Avenue, and Teenager in Love. We'll talk with Johnny Adams, who has a new album of lesser-known songs by Pomus. We'll call Dr. John, who co-wrote many of the songs on the new album, and we'll talk with music critic Peter Guralnik. Also today, writing a new constitution for Czechoslovakia. We talk with First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbis, who helped draft the constitution now under consideration in the newly democratic country. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new collection of essays on campus politics and pop culture by journalist John Wiener. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Serbian-dominated Federal Army has admitted that one of its Yugoslav planes shot down a European Community helicopter over Croatia today, killing the five monitors on board. A second helicopter was forced to make an emergency landing. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Yugoslavia for the attack. Kathy Jenkins reports from Zagreb.
In a brief statement, the Federal Army expressed regret for what it called an unwanted and tragic event. It said an urgent inquiry was being launched and that measures would be taken against those responsible. The helicopter exploded in midair after being hit by a rocket. The five EC monitors on board, four Italian and one French, were killed. Witnesses said the wreckage was spread over a four-kilometer area. A second helicopter made an emergency landing. The four monitors in that helicopter are not thought to have been injured. The attack occurred near the town of Varaždin to the north of Zagreb. The Croatian Ministry of Interior said that federal planes had been spotted above Zagreb. The attack happened shortly afterwards. The helicopters were flying from Belgrade to the Croatian capital. Their schedule had been made known before they set off, and diplomats say it would have been impossible to mistake them. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Jenkins in Zagreb.
President Bush today spoke to a group of Japanese college students. He told them that he came to their country as a friend, but he stressed that he will not accept piecemeal agreements to end the U.S.-Japanese trade imbalance. The president will meet Japanese Prime Minister Kiichi Miyazawa tomorrow. Meanwhile, representatives for the big three automakers today said they have suggested to the president that he give Japan 5 years to eliminate its trade surplus with the United States. The surplus grew to $42 billion last year. General Motors and Ford have announced plans to ship U.S.-built right-hand drive cars to Japan. The move is seen as an important step in making American vehicles more appealing to Japanese car buyers. Don Gagne reports.
GM officials say they will equip Saturn vehicles built at the automaker's Tennessee plant with right-hand drive. Ford, meanwhile, will offer a similar version of its Probe model to be assembled at a Detroit-area Mazda plant, which builds Ford cars under a joint venture between the two automakers. GM and Ford won't say how many right-hand drive cars they'll build, but Saturn Vice President Don Hudler says in 10 years the vehicle should represent a significant portion of Saturn's overall business.
We're looking at it as strictly a long-term opportunity to further broaden Saturn, have the discipline of being a global competitor, and going head-to-head around the world.
The move shows a willingness on the part of U.S. automakers to design cars for the Japanese market, something they've been criticized for not doing in the past. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today and set yet another record. The Dow gained nearly 5 points to end the day at 3204.83. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi says her delegation will travel to the next round of peace talks in Washington. Ashrawi said the United Nations' denunciation of Israeli plans to expel 12 Palestinians from the occupied territories helped to clear the way. She points out that it is too early to tell if Israel will comply with the world body and noted that Israel does not always do so. But Ashrawi said the resolution will keep the matter under review by the world body, and this encourages her and her other fellow negotiators. The Salvadoran army and FMLN rebels today report that fighting is going on despite a peace agreement that was signed on New Year's Eve. A formal truce is scheduled to be signed on January 16th in Mexico City. Both sides blame each other for provoking the continuing violence. On the first day of his trial, the former mayor of Dresden has admitted falsifying election results for the communist government. Deidre Berger reports.
Wolfgang Berghofer, who is one of the best-known Communist Party reformers in East Germany, told a Dresden court today he, quote, corrected 1989 election results. He claims he had considerable misgivings about the manipulation, which he says was ordered by leaders of the Communist Party, including Hans Modrow, who later became the country's last communist leader. The true election participation of 90% in the 1989 Dresden local elections was raised to 98%, and the 12% vote for the opposition was lowered to 2.5%. Berghofer's lawyers claim elections in the communist system were a tool of a totalitarian regime and cannot be considered free elections. Therefore, Berghofer's lawyers are trying to get the case dismissed. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
United News of India today reported 13 Maoist guerrillas were killed in a gun battle with police in southern India. The news report said the guerrillas fired first upon the police after first setting off a bomb underneath their jeep. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We lost one of rock and roll's great songwriters last year, Doc Pomus.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye, let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know.
Oh, I know.
That's just one of the many classics written by the late Doc Pomus. The Drifters recorded that along with Pomus's This Magic Moment and I Count the Tears. Ray Charles recorded his song Lonely Avenue. Dion had a hit with Pomus's Teenager in Love. And for Elvis, Pomus wrote his latest flame, Little Sister, and Viva Las Vegas. Many of these songs were co-written with Mort Schumann. After their partnership ended in 1965, Pomus gave up songwriting for several years. When he started again, one of his collaborators was Dr. John. A new album produced by Dr. John features Johnny Adams singing some of Pomus's lesser-known songs. While this project was in the works, Pomus died of lung cancer at the age of 65. Today on Fresh Air, we'll talk with Dr. John, singer Johnny Adams, and music critic Peter Guralnick. First, some music. Most of the songs on the new Johnny Adams album are from the latter part of Doc Pomus's life, but this song predates his hits. It was first recorded by Joe Turner in 1952. Here's Johnny Adams.
You loved me, and you left me. Now you're laughing. Now you're laughing, 'cause I'm still in love with you.
Still in love from the new album Johnny Adams sings Doc Pomus. Music critic Peter Guralnick is writing a biography of Elvis Presley. He was a friend of Doc Pomus and had written about him as well. I asked Peter Guralnick to describe Pomus as a songwriter.
There were several surprising things about Doc. I think the thing is that he conceived himself as a blues man overall, as someone who started out singing the blues and then started writing blues really in order to supply himself with material. It was only when other people began to record his music that he became a songwriter as such. He was a little bit like Percy Mayfield, I suppose, but different than him, too, in the sense that he didn't stick at all. From the very beginning, he didn't stick to the blues form. He had a sense of pop music, and his model, really, which is quite surprising, or was quite surprising to me when he first talked about it, was Irving Berlin. And the song that he always held up as the model for what he wanted to get across, for economy of craft and also for economy of emotion, for the suggestion of emotion, was always, I think, what he saw as its special mark was the way in which everything turned on that single word, and yet the word kept changing meaning throughout the song. And this is the kind of thing that you see, particularly as he got older and as he wrote songs that were more and more direct emotionally, that I think expressed more and more what was the underpinning for all of his songwriting, but which was hidden more by pop craft in the earlier years. As he got closer and closer to that, to this direct expression, I think you can actually see that Irving Berlin influence.
I'm going to ask you to describe Doc Pomus physically, because that was such an important part of who he was.
Well, Doc had polio when he was six. He went off to camp because there was a polio scare in the city, and he got polio at the camp that he went to in Connecticut, I think. And so he was in a wheelchair for the last, it must have been the last 20 years of his life. He was somebody who envisioned himself as a kid. His description of his ambition was that he wanted to be the first heavyweight champion of the world on crutches. And he went to enormous lengths to make himself independent. When I met him, it was after he had had a fall and he was no longer on crutches, but all the pictures you see of him in the early days, when he was a blues singer playing the black clubs in Brooklyn and in New Jersey, he was on crutches. But in the time that I knew him, the last 15 years of his life, I guess, he was in a wheelchair, and he was an immense man. He was very imposing looking. He had a white beard, and he dressed in very striking colors, and might wear some kind of a serape or a poncho, and he loved hats. He definitely made a statement, and he was just a big presence sitting there in his wheelchair.
Doc Pomus gave up songwriting for a period starting in, I think it was 1965. Why did he stop writing songs?
I think there was a confluence of events in his life, personal events, and also he took a bad fall, ended up in the hospital for a very lengthy period of time, and never got back on crutches after that. Plus, I think Doc later might have said that he made a wrong call in thinking that the whole rock and roll era was over, that there just wasn't room for the kind of songs that he wrote, and that whatever he had achieved was past. And so he walked away from it, would be the wrong word, but he moved away from it. And for a number of years, he supported himself as a professional card player.
Pomus started as a blues singer. That was a short-lived career, and then he turned to songwriting. A lot of his early songs were really rock and roll songs, although his first love was the blues. Do you think that the Johnny Adams interpretations of Pomus's more recent songs kind of go back to his original interest in a way, the original sound that he had in mind?
I think that the Johnny Adams interpretation of his songs were the interpretations that he dreamt of. I think they were in a sense a step forward, because the songs that he was writing at the end were beyond anything that he had ever written before. They were so much more direct emotionally. They had so much more of a personal bent to them. And they were blues, but they were not formal blues in the way that the earliest songs that he had written were. But I think they were a much deeper feeling, and certainly, which is the reason that for me, I would say that I prize this would be a statement I could very rarely make, just as an observer, but I would prize his last songs more than anything he ever wrote.
Peter, do you have a favorite on the new album, or a song that you think emotionally is closest to Pomus? Or more autobiographical.
I couldn't pick out a single favorite. I mean, I think that the real me is Doc, right, just down to his socks. I mean, it's just the real me is just a naked statement, and the way that Johnny sings it to me puts it across in that way.
Peter Guralnick, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Guralnick's latest book is Searching for Robert Johnson. Here's The Real Me, the title track from Johnny Adams' new album.
no one ever saw or wanted to see the real me. I was hiding and sometimes sliding from the real me. No one ever found a reason to take a moment or a season to find the real me. The real me.
Doc Pomus co-wrote that song with Dr. John. They wrote hundreds of songs together. Seven of them are included on this new album. Dr. John also produced the album and is featured on piano. Dr. John is a pianist and songwriter from New Orleans who is steeped in rock and roll and rhythm and blues and has written many songs on his own, including Such a Night and Right Place, Wrong Time. Dr. John told me one of his heroes was Doc Pomus.
He always had these great lyrical ideas, and he had a real, like, a old traditional blues ballad touch for songs. And I mean, I was a fan of Doc Pomus from when I first saw, like, I'm Still in Love with You by Big Joe Turner in the 40s when I was a kid. I thought, wow, that's a great song. Love it, and I looked to see who the writer was, and it was like Joe Turner had already been a hero of mine. I used to look for names of people that wrote songs I liked from when I was a youngster, you know.
Is there anything that you think writing with Doc Pomus brought out in you that is different from the way you usually write?
Well, I tell you what it was. It was Doc looked for something that most people that I had written with for a long time wasn't interested in, which is those real natural kind of songs that come out of, like, no trying to make them into hit records, just songs that mean something. I mean, I guarantee you we was asked to write songs for a lot of people that would like to write, make pop hit records. And it was, I don't know, our heart was never into it as a writing together, but if somebody, B.B. King, wanted a song, or somebody that sang something that related to what the kind of stuff we were writing, we'd, you know, bust our ass for them, you know?
Now, Johnny Adams sings your songs that you wrote with Doc Pomus on the new record. Do you think of Johnny Adams as almost a dying breed, the rhythm and blues ballad singer?
Well, I look at Johnny as much more than a rhythm and blues ballad singer. I look at Johnny as a great gospel singer, a great jazz singer, and a great blues and rhythm and blues singer. And I think he excels in all of those areas. And I think that's why Johnny Adams and guys like Joe Hinton and O.V. Wright, Jackie Wilson, and a few other singers have always excelled at what they did in that direction, because they came out of singing in sanctified churches and moved on to other levels of music. But Johnny's developed, you know, he's a great jazz singer and does very unique. He does a very unique thing on that album where he does a trombone solo with his mouth that's shades of great trombone players of the past.
Well, Dr. John, thanks a lot for taking some time out to talk with us.
Well, thank you for talking to me, and I'm very honored to be spoken to about anything do with Doc Pomus or Johnny Adams.
Dr. John, we'll hear from singer Johnny Adams after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Johnny Adams sings some of the lesser-known songs of Doc Pomus on his new album, The Real Me. Before we meet him, this is Adams singing Blinded by Love, co-written by Doc Pomus and Dr. John.
Goodbye. I should have known by the tears in her eyes what you only see. What you want it to be. When you're blinded by love, and love sure has blinded me.
Johnny Adams is from New Orleans. He had several regional R&B hits in the late 50s and early 60s. Over the past few years, he's made a series of albums for Rounder Records. The Doc Pomus album is the latest. Adams started off singing in gospel quartets. I asked him which part he sang.
I was singing every part but bass.
Uh-huh.
From tenor to fifth, lead to baritone to lead, you know.
As someone who wasn't a church-going person yourself, how did you feel about singing gospel music?
Well, during that time, I did join church. It wasn't a thing that I thought I was going to sing gospel songs that I needed to belong to church. It's that I felt these things in my heart, you know, that, you know, what any good Christian should feel. You've got to have this in your heart, not just in your soul. It's got to be in your heart. You have to believe, I guess. And so I eventually joined church, baptized and joined church. And it wasn't a play thing, actually. Like I said, when I started singing in church, I could feel the Holy Spirit before I start singing, as soon as I get in the church, you know.
When you stopped singing gospel music, did you stay with the church?
A little while. Then I thought to myself, if I'm going to do rhythm and blues or whatever, that I don't need to be fooling myself about doing rhythm and blues Friday or Saturday and go to church on Sundays and do gospel. Because that's a no-no to me. I don't, and still don't believe in that. You have to do one or the other, because you can't serve two. You can go to church naturally and be thankful for your blessings and or give thanks for your blessings and whatever, but even if I was a musician, you know, to play in the church today and have to go out that same night and play in some club that... I always think I was doing something wrong. I feel like I was doing something wrong. So I try to do it right and stick to what I'm doing and still be grateful. I still ask for my blessings.
Why did you leave gospel and turn to rhythm and blues? How did that happen?
Well, I guess at the time you become curious, you know, about certain things. Then you want to find out what's on the other side. But in, you know, with the first song I recorded, I was more curious than anything else. And when I recorded I Won't Cry, it became, you know, an instant hit. Not because I was a gospel singer, because of the song itself, I guess. And I don't know, I've been going ever since.
Were you offered that song, or did you ask for that song?
Yes. I used to live in an apartment house along with Doris Lobastri. She used to write songs for Little Richard a while back. You know, like Tutti Frutti and a couple other songs. And she would ask me all the time about doing a song for her, you know. And I would tell her, no, I'm not interested because I'm singing quartet and stuff like this. So I guess out of, uh, don't know, you can call it frustration or whatever, during the time of, you know, the gospel era with me. You say, well, nothing's happening anyway, so I just as well try this and see what happens. So I thought to myself, why not? You know, so finally I did it. She asked me about a year to do that. And I made up my mind, and we just went on down Rampart Street, and this is where Joe Ruffino had his little studio at the time. And we got together with Dr. John and Edgar Blanchett and the Gondoliers during that time, and recorded this I Won't Cry and I Won't Shed a Tear.
It's funny that you and Dr. John go back that far.
Oh, yes.
For our listeners who don't remember the song, could I ask you to sing a couple of lines of it?
Darling, I found out a long time ago you found someone else, you don't need me anymore. But I'll keep on loving you just the same. I won't cry and I won't shed a tear. I'll keep on loving you year after year. Even though you left me, oh, I won't cry.
Mm. Well, that sounds wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering if you think there are many new songs written in the style that you like to sing, or if it's hard to find new material.
No, it's, I think most songs that I like to sing has to have a meaning. And they're not always the shouting type songs that I like. You know, unless you're in a club, you know, where folks can't really hear what's going on, then you have to belt one out once in a while. And when I have to record fast songs, it takes away from true artistry. It takes away from singing sometimes to me. I like ballads and blues ballads or gospel ballad, whatever it is, you know. But I don't like a lot of shouting all the time.
Johnny Adams, do you have a favorite from your new Doc Pomus album?
Yes, I like One More Time. It's a beautiful song. Very pretty song. I like the meaning of the song, in other words. It's a very beautiful story. You know, it talks about whatever you plan to do. If you on a Monday and it doesn't work out, don't give it up. Give it till Tuesday. It's always better. And that, you know, it's one more time. You give yourself another chance to think it over. And that's the part I like, you know, the meaning I like in the song. It's a beautiful song. One More Time.
Johnny Adams, his new album, Johnny Adams Sings Doc Pomus, The Real Me, is on Rounder Records. Doc Pomus will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If your whole life somehow wasn't much till now, and you've almost lost your will to live. No matter what you've been through, long as there's breath in you, there is always.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Countries in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics are making the transition from communism to democracy. Coming up, we talk with First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus, who helped draft a new constitution in Czechoslovakia. That country is dealing with questions that all the former communist countries must face. How do you deal with former party officials? Should secret police files be opened? And what, if any, limitations should be placed on freedom of speech? Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Professors, Politics, and Pop, a new collection of essays on campus politics and pop culture by journalist John Wiener. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, the Federal Army has conceded that one of its airplanes shot down a European Community helicopter, killing five EC truce observers. The EC helicopter blew up in the air after it was hit by an air-to-air missile about 30 miles north of Zagreb. Pierre Vickery reports that the downing comes on the eve of a UN Security Council debate on the Yugoslav crisis.
Croatian state television began its main evening news bulletins with footage from the crash site in northeastern Croatia. Debris from the downed helicopter was scattered over a wide area. The bodies of the five community monitors still wearing their white uniforms. Eyewitnesses claim they saw two MiG fighter planes of the Yugoslav Air Force attack the helicopters, firing at least three air-to-air rockets. One helicopter exploded in midair, the other managed to make an emergency landing. Both the French and Italian defense ministries confirmed the crash, releasing the names of the four Italians and the Frenchman killed in the attack. Serbian state television also reported the accident. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A Syrian official says that all the Arab diplomatic delegations to the next round of the Middle Eastern peace talks will leave for Washington sometime this week. The Arab diplomats had delayed their travel plans after Israeli officials decided to expel 12 Palestinians. Yesterday, the UN Security Council strongly condemned the Israeli move. The Middle Eastern peace talks had been scheduled to resume today in Washington. The American Medical Association has published a new study that shows the waiting list for donated organs has grown dramatically despite new federal laws aimed at making the wait shorter. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
More than 23,000 Americans are now waiting for replacement kidneys, hearts, livers, and other organs. That's a 77% increase over just 4 years ago. But the new study shows that donations during that time have increased only slightly. That's despite several federal laws designed to streamline the organ procurement system and to encourage more people to donate organs. Another study in the journal shows that black people have to wait longer than whites for organs. That's largely because organs don't transplant well from one race to another, and black people are less likely to donate organs. But part of the reason is also that white people are more likely to have the financial means to sign up for transplants at several hospitals, and that gives them places on more waiting lists. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
10 inches of snow caused flight cancellations and long delays at Denver's Stapleton International Airport. All 70 airport snowplows have been working to clear the runways. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 5 points to close at 3,204. This is NPR News. Airline officials say that a Delta Airlines jet landed safely at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport after one of its engines fell off during takeoff. The plane, a Boeing 737-300, was on its way to Houston when the incident occurred. There were no injuries, and the engine was found on airport property. The Canadian government has protested to China the expulsion of three Canadian members of parliament. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said that the diplomats were deported for activities not compatible with their status. Humphrey Hawksley filed this report for the BBC.
The Canadian MPs said they were outraged at the way they had been treated by the Chinese authorities. They had planned to go to a Peking jail where several are held and pay tribute at Tiananmen Square where troops crushed the democracy movement in 1989. The MPs said they were on a bus going back to their hotel when it suddenly turned down a side street into a police compound. One of them, Sven Robinson, said they were treated roughly and made to get into a van.
We were kidnapped on a bus, held against our will. The diplomat, the Canadian diplomat with us, was also kidnapped. He showed them his diplomatic passport, was refused the right to either leave or make a phone call.
China is always sensitive to criticism about its human rights record, but these expulsions come as Peking is emerging from its international isolation.
Humphrey Hawksley reporting from Hong Kong. Officials in Washington say that U.S. Army helicopters have been flying supplies to Kurdish groups in northern Iraq. A Pentagon spokesman says the airlift began last Friday and will continue until roads can be cleared of snow and U.N. teams can get through. Spokesman Pete Williams says that there has been heavy snowfall in northern Iraq during the last few days, and so the U.S. military has provided airlift support. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the fall of 1989, as Czechoslovakia was beginning its transition from communism to democracy, American lawyer Martin Garbus was in Prague going over early drafts of a constitution for the new democratic government that was about to take power. Garbus, who specializes in human rights and First Amendment law, joined other Western lawyers in working with Havel's government to come up with a document based on democratic principles. Together, they wrestled with issues ranging from how to divide power between the Czech and Slovak republics and the federal government, to whether secret files of the Communist Party should be open to the press. The Constitution has been drafted and is now before the Parliament. Since Garbus's specialty is the First Amendment, one of the most cherished parts of our Constitution, I wanted to know if there were controversies over freedom of speech.
Well, I can remember one incident which was kind of illustrative of everything. It's illustrative of the difficulties of putting American concepts or American constitutions in foreign countries. I gave a speech at one time where I was talking about the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and giving a very wide interpretation of the First Amendment, a kind of Black Douglas view, a Warren Court view. And I spoke, and after I spoke for about an hour, everybody applauded. Then we had a coffee break, and during the coffee break, everybody said that what I had said was wonderful, and that you should have free speech and everybody should be able to say what they want. And then somebody came up during the coffee break and said everything is wonderful. Yes, but of course you don't mean that you should then be able to criticize public officials. And during the course of that discussion, which is of course exactly what I did mean, and during the course of that discussion, we got into the whole question of trying to place one set of concepts. I felt like, to some extent, a constitutional imperialist, one set of concepts in another culture. I mean, one of the problems you had in Czechoslovakia and other countries in Central Europe was the realization that when the new governments came into power, the highest probability was that the old apparatchik would still control the press and would still control a lot of the media. So they did not want to permit a system, conceptually, where you would have somebody like Havel or Yeltsin in power, and then the press, which was still controlled by the apparatchiks, could say anything you wanted about these people. So in a sense, what they saw was the contradiction, the anomaly, of giving the former apparatchiks, the former communists, the people who had denied wide free press rights, you were saying give them those rights so that they could be totally free, and there was the fear that if you gave those, the communists, the apparatchiks, those rights, they would then bring down the governments which the people wanted.
Well, let's get back to freedom of speech. How is that handled now in the draft of the Constitution?
Well, any constitution ultimately is compromised, as is our constitution. And I think the way it's handled in the present constitution is in many ways not unlike it had been handled in the communist constitution. Namely, it talks about freedom of speech, but at the same time, it allows for the government to protect itself if it feels that there's too much speech. It talks about national emergencies and things like that. Now, the reality is that's a small hole for which you can drive a truck. So the ultimate conclusion and the ultimate answer to all this stuff is that constitutions are interpreted by judges, and the Constitution is what the judge says it is. And in Czechoslovakia, as in Russia and as in any of the other Central European countries, the Constitution will be what the judges say it is, irrespective of how you word the Constitution. And how the judges say it is will to some extent depend on the political culture in which the Constitution is interpreted. You can have, for example, when Pinochet came to power in Chile in 1973, you had under Allende and prior to Allende, the best, one of the best constitutions in the world. It talked about women's rights. It talked about due process. It talked about child care. It talked about full employment. And, of course, it talked about habeas corpus. And, of course, Pinochet then came in. And for a while, even the same constitution was kept in place, but they just totally emasculated it. So that when you write a constitution, you realize that you're doing a small job. It's a small building block. And a large part of constitution writing is the constitution as teacher, the constitution as a document which sets goals, the document as a document which sets aspirations. And hopefully, if the document sets goals of freedom, of protection, of stopping government encroachment, then that message will infuse itself throughout the other institutions that are going to be created. The Constitution is just one document that helps create these institutions.
That must have been a slightly frustrating attitude to have while drafting such an important document, realizing its importance and its limitations at the same time.
It is frustrating. On the other hand, to think otherwise would be to be arrogant and I think to be unaware of the culture in which the document is written. I think that the benefit that we have had having a constitution for 200 years, which every sentence and every comma is endlessly interpreted, is an extraordinary luxury. When I was in Czechoslovakia, people would ask questions like, let's say, relating to Ellsberg problems, publication of documents that might threaten national security, or some of the issues that our Supreme Court is considering now, hate speech and issues like that. And when they asked the questions, or depending on how I phrased the problem, and I were to tell them, well, I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know how the court's going to decide, they were astonished.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Garbus, who's a First Amendment lawyer, and he helped to draft the Constitution that's now under consideration in Czechoslovakia. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus, who helped draft the Czechoslovakian Constitution. You've written that one of the most contentious questions during the writing of the Constitution was, should the new government open the secret archives of the communist regime? Can you give us a sense of why that issue has been so controversial and remains so controversial in Czechoslovakia?
Well, the question is, who collaborated with the with the previous government? To what extent was there a collaboration? There's a magic word now called lustration in Czechoslovakia. There's and the question is, a lustration law has been enacted by the Federal Assembly, and it deals with the question of whether people who previously held positions in the communist government should be permitted to hold positions in the new government. It also deals with the whole question of the files. Now, the difficulty there dealt with the whole problem of people who previously were allegedly collaborators. Now, you could find your name in the files even if you were not officially collaborating, but if, for example, a KGB or an official of the Czechoslovakian secret police were to go to you getting information from you, and if you did not know he was a member of the secret police, but he would and you did not realize you were collaborating or cooperating, he would take you to lunch, get some information, and then he would report perhaps in his file that he had spoken with you and that you had given them the following information. And many times, many members of the secret police, in order to justify work and energy and effort on their part, would indicate that they had spoken to people that, in fact, they had not spoken to, and they would create false information. So there'd be a great danger to opening up those files. A lot of innocent people would be hurt. On the other hand, those files would show a lot of the inner workings of the secret police and of those people who are collaborators.
And some people say it's censorship to keep those files closed.
Yes, and then the critical issue is to say that you should keep the files closed is to start to censor government documents at the very beginning of the new government. In other words, in America, we have the FOIA Acts, which basically, let's say, open up documents similar to these. So it's very difficult to walk into a new emerging democracy and say, no, these files should be kept private because innocent people will be hurt. It's probably true that innocent people will be hurt. It is true that innocent people will be hurt. And maybe you could say, well, you should censor some documents and not others, but then the question is, who becomes the censor? Now the reality is that the people who were really high up and who did the terrible things, their names probably are not going to be in these files. It's basically going to be the lower-level people who are speaking to other lower-level people. And then you get into the great moral issues, like if you are forced to cooperate because of fear or because of pressure, and you do things that in retrospect you ought not to have done, or if you do it to save your husband or wife's life or your children's lives, or you do it somehow so that you can survive, even for economic reasons, so that you can have more bread than not. And if you do that at any time over 25 years or the entire period of the time that the Czechs were under Soviet domination, how much should you be punished for it? And what are the moral issues relating to all of that?
Well, let me ask you what kind of advice you gave on the question of opening up the secret communist files.
Well, I think that it dealt with different things. In other words, it dealt with the kind of advice that I gave was to try and have some kind of committee look at the files and see what the problems were and try and make some original decisions and then have somebody make decisions about what should be kept quiet, if anything, and if there was a determination certain things should be kept quiet, then some kind of judicial procedure whereby the judgments to keep things quiet could be checked out. I think it's a difficult issue, and it's one that gives one a lot of concern. I mean, one could argue that if you opened up all the files and if everybody saw how specious and how false a lot of the accusations were, then it would all wash away and people would not be hurt. And maybe what should happen is one of the other suggestions I gave was that have all the files opened up after a period of time, after the original tensions of the governments coming together and a lot of the revenge feelings dissipate, so that maybe the procedure that I had suggested would be appropriate for 2 to 3 years, but then let's say in 1993 have all the files opened. So that would allow the government to get started. Also, the other thing you don't want to see is you don't want to see a government caught in an endless revenge bath. And I presume as economic times get harder throughout Central Europe and as well as in what had been the Soviet Union where these same issues arise, then I think that people can just become focused, or countries can become focused on punishing the wrongdoers, because that would seem to be easy, rather than dealing with the much harder economic problems that have to be dealt with.
The lustration laws include a 5-year ban on hiring former communist officials in government or private managerial posts. Are you opposed to that?
I think I'm opposed to it. I think there are a lot of distinctions that have to be made. I think that it's wrong to say that merely because somebody is a formerly a communist official that he is therefore guilty and should be punished. I think there are many people in that area who should be punished. But remember, in Czechoslovakia, you had, I don't have the number in front of me, an extraordinary number of people who were members of the Communist Party. And a lot of them were not mendacious, a lot of them were not terrible, a lot of them were doing it in order to survive. So I think that I oppose that. I think that, and the thing that I would hate to see would be, I mean, there are very severe problems, namely keeping the Czechs and Slovaks together, and the obsession with lustration law should not overrule the prime issues in the country.
As you said, one of the controversies surrounding the Constitution now is how to keep the Czechs and the Slovaks united, but with an ample amount of independence at the same time?
Yes, with an ample amount of interplay, so that each of the countries or each of the subdivisions of the country can have their own ethnic development, can have their own feelings of national pride, and not feel that their minorities are being oppressed by some kind of majority rule.
Now, this is an issue for just about every republic
Yes. In
the Soviet Union and the former Eastern Bloc countries, where we've seen so much ethnic fighting from within. So what are the ways that that the Constitution of Czechoslovakia might handle this?
Well, they can talk about certain areas being able to set up their own schools. They can talk about certain areas having local control. I mean, the American Constitution, for example, which provides for majority rule, or the American form of government, which provides for majority rule, basically allows the majority to do bad things to the minority. In other words, if 50% of the people vote for something, then the other 49% of the people can be made to eat it, can be made to stuff it, can be made to swallow laws that they don't agree with or that they find offensive, except to the extent that they offend the Constitution. So the Constitution is the document that protects minorities. Now, that's a very subtle interplay, majority rule with minorities protected. And that's what you're trying to define in the Central European countries. And the way that which the checks and balance system that we have worked out is perhaps America's most profound contribution to Western thought, what our forefathers did 200 years ago. And when I say what our forefathers did, it was done 200 years ago, but then you had Chief Justice Marshall and you had Supreme Courts and other people over the 200 years interpreting it and making it practical. It's very hard to start something like that afresh in these countries. It's as hard to resolve these majoritarian minority problems as it is to go from one kind of economy to another. And it's clear to me that that's not totally recognized.
Our constitution is difficult to change. What about the Czechoslovakian constitution?
Well, those constitutions will be easier to change because there's not the kind of reverence they will have for the constitution. The reason our constitution is so difficult is because we have this feeling that what our founding fathers thought was really extraordinarily important and kind of comes out of the sky or from the mountain. I think their feeling will be somewhat different. They won't have the reverence for it. Also, they won't have a judiciary to constantly interpret it in the same way as ours. So they'll have a legislature there, which will probably add and subtract things rather easily. For example, in Manila, we have a 417-page constitution. It's changed constantly.
It's like something's going on outside your office.
Yeah, right. This is New York.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Martin Garbus is a First Amendment lawyer based in New York. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll have a report from Sylvia Poggioli about the downing of a helicopter and the killing of 5 European Community observers over Croatia and Yugoslavia. Also, a Serbian-American's view of the conflict between Serbs and Croats in Yugoslavia. And also on this Orthodox Christmas, we'll be hearing a report on Russian Christmas carols being sung in Russia with new openness and fervor this Christmas. Also, President Bush's trip to the East and U.S. auto executives say they're angry at Japanese trade practices. Those stories and others coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Anyone who knows anyone in academia knows that the ivory towers can often be stained in bloody battles. Professors, Politics, and Pop is a new collection of essays by historian and journalist John Wiener about campus politics and the politics of pop culture. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
John Wiener professes history at the University of California, Irvine. He wrote a book called Social Origins of the New South. But he also wrote a book called Come Together, John Lennon and His Time. This is because Wiener's a child of the 60s, and his definition of history is elastic enough to include rock and roll. Neither of these books, however, explains why Jacques Derrida, the godfather of deconstruction, should have complained in public, and I quote, "It is frightening to think that John Wiener teaches history at a university." Wiener, you see, wrote several articles savaging the deconstructionists for the way they tried to alibi themselves and their guru when we all found out that Paul de Man had been a Nazi collaborator. If you are as much in favor of frightening Jacques Derrida as I am, you'll enjoy this collection of Wiener's essays as much as I did. In periodicals like The Nation and The New Republic, The Journal of American History, and The Journal of Social History, Wiener takes the modern university as his beat and covers it like a police reporter. He not only goes to the scene of the thought crime, but interviews the victims and interrogates the suspects and makes fun of the courts. Wiener's mean streets are the think tank, the scholarly symposium, and the faculty lounge. And when he's had enough of this academic lowlife, he listens to Elvis, Springsteen, and the Beatles. He even listens to Frank Sinatra. Deconstructionists are a good place to start, because all of de Man's apologists, while behaving disgracefully, cited the loftiest of principles for doing so. That's the way it goes on campus. There may be racism, sexism, union busting, and financial footsie with South Africa, but the excuses for indecency are better written, with footnotes. Wiener looks at feminist scholars, contradicting one another at the Sears trial for sex discrimination, at economists who did terrible things to Bolivia and Poland, at sociologists who smuggled war criminals into tenured slots in American universities after the war, at scientists selling out their academic freedom to biotech conglomerates for lucrative patents, at right-wing foundations buying themselves entire curricula on money-hungry campuses, at left-wing legal studies movements rewriting the materials and methodologies of law reviews, and at schools for spies, like Yale. He is least persuasive in his tortured defense of some sort of campus code to protect minority sensibilities against abusive speech. Speech codes of any sort are a gag on all of us, somewhere down the ideological line. Not so surprisingly for a radical, Wiener in his essays on music pays more attention to the politics than he does to the playfulness of pop culture. But you'll be nevertheless amazed to hear that Sinatra was once a pinko, the target of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, that the FBI spent more time going after John Lennon than Jimmy Hoffa, trying to deport him before the 1972 Republican convention, and that Elvis volunteered himself to Nixon as an undercover drug enforcement agent. In other words, nobody behaves well. We just expect more from college men. Unlike Derrida, I, for one, am pleased that Wiener teaches history anywhere he wants to.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Professors, Politics, and Pop by John Wiener. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fourteen years ago, journalist Soledad Santiago's marriage fell apart, and she ended up homeless with two children. For a brief time, she lived in one of New York's notorious shelters. She later became a press officer for the state of New York and a novelist. We'll talk with her on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.